I'd like to introduce our speaker for today, who will speak till 10:10 and will then answer any questions from the audience. Ladies and gentlemen, let's please welcome Danny from Long Beach.
Hi, my name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. And thanks, Vincent. Thanks, Mary, for my water. And Skip and Al for greeting me. I immediately felt welcome, of course, as I tend to do in any meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I am well aware that I belong. This is a great meeting, you guys. You haven't been here before, but I love the format. And I love that third step prayer, that reading. I go to a meeting in Long Beach. A 7 a.m. meeting, and we, during the meeting, we say both the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, but I haven't actually heard it, you know, with the reading, and it was just really powerful to hear the group. And I want to thank, it was Red that actually asked me to come and speak today, and he's a good friend, and I want to, even though he's not here, I do want to thank him. I always have to remember, it's an honor and a privilege to do anything in and for Alcoholics Anonymous. I was sitting listening to you guys sharing and just feeling really, really grateful. Alcoholics Anonymous not only saved my life, it gave me a life. Before I got here, I really just simply existed, and barely at that. And I want to thank my friend Crystal and boyfriend Sam for coming with me and supporting me as well. And I'll just get right into my story. My sobriety date is March 4th of 2007. It's not my first. I hope it's my last. I grew up in Southern California, not here, but in the San Fernando Valley, and nice little, upper class, upper middle class, Jewish girl from the Valley. And I had two really great parents. They did the absolute best job that they could. And an older sister who adored me and loved me to death and took care of me. None of them are alcoholics. I had a pretty good childhood. All things considered, whatever bumps in the road, all families go through, but nothing really too traumatic. I hail from the, versus the sort of rebel side of AA, I hail from the A-type perfectionist side of AA, and I was the good one and the perfectionist and, always worked really, really hard to be perfect all the time. So when I took my first drink at a college party with my older sister at the age of 14 and got completely hammered, drunk, blacked out, passed out, just had no idea. And I woke up the next day and I couldn't wait to do it again. I finally had a piece of relief. And I discovered that when I drank, I didn't have to be so perfect. It gave me an excuse to be bad. And, so from that moment on, because I'd gotten so sick the first time I drank, other budding alcoholic, I decided that maybe the mixture between orange juice and vodka was too acidic on my stomach. And and if I tried maybe some other mixtures, that would go over a little bit better. But I absolutely became the epitome of the weekend warrior. I was really good Monday through Friday. Friday night, Saturday night, forget about it. And then I would recover on Sunday, start again on Monday. And that's how I proceeded through high school. That's how I actually made it into college. And that's how I made it through college. And I was never quite, I didn't know this at the time, of course, but I, there was something, my family was great, but for some reason I never quite felt like they weren't really my people. And, as I grew up, I sort of looked out to my friends to be my people. And then after a time, they weren't my people anymore. And the valley was a problem. I never fit in there. And then it wasn't just the valley, but it was the entire county of Los Angeles. And then it wasn't, and then, you know, ugh, those LA people. And then, ugh, the whole state of California, they just have different values. And I ended up going to school in Pullman, Washington, at Washington State. I had no idea at the time, but and when I went there, it was like something like the sixth ranked, you know, party school in Playboy's top 10 or something like that. And I didn't know, I just knew that I fit in. And everyone I knew drank like I drank. And so that's when I proceeded through college, and I ended up, you know, doing how I do. I was a pretty good functional, you know, budding alcoholic at the time still, you know. I'd get really wasted on the weekends. You know, I started doing, you know, some recreational drugs, but, you know, nothing too over the top. And I ended up, you know, graduating from college and following a lot of my friends to Seattle. And Seattle was perfect for me at the time. It was the early 90s, and grunge was there, and lots of bars and music. And the one thing I always remember is living in Seattle in the early 90s gave me every single reason to be super, super pissed off for absolutely no reason. My life was fine. I, again, had this great family, had plenty of friends. I had a college degree, you know, there was a lot of, Seattle was booming economically at the time, there was no lack for jobs, yet, you know, I was, you know, in my Doc Martens and my flannel shirts, you know, and my hair's not dark enough, I had dyed it black, and I could be really angry everywhere I went. And my drinking at the time was still not, you know, hadn't really become too serious. But I did realize I was starting to drink like a little bit more than some of my friends who were starting to grow up. And I found a really great job that was down the street from a really bad bar. And I found a drinking buddy at that job. And, you know, it was as simple as, hey, Dan, you want to go up the street and grab a beer after work today? You know, on a Thursday? Sure. You know, and then a couple weeks later, hey, Dan, you want to go up for work and, I mean, you want to go up after work and have a drink? You know, and she'd ask me like around 2 o'clock. Sure. And then I couldn't stop thinking about waiting to get off work and go up and have that drink. And she and I would sit at that bar drinking pitcher after pitcher after pitcher of beer, you know, until like 10 or 11, and but it was still, you know, it wasn't taking on too serious proportions. And I love it, like, I love the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and, you know, in a couple different places in that book, it sort of refers to this idea of this invisible line that we cross from when we're just, like, you know, drinkers and then heavy drinkers, and then all of a sudden we realize we can't stop even if we wanted to, which I never wanted to, but and one time I was actually sitting in a book study, and someone was like, God, Danny, when did you cross that invisible line? You know, and the best response I had was sometime in the 90s. Because what happened was I just started going up to the bar after work, you know, every once in a while. But over the course of about 5 or 6 years, every once in a while, you know, that started out on a, you know, a Friday or a Thursday, suddenly became Wednesday, and then it became Tuesday. And then after work was 6:30, but then it was 6, and then it was 5:30, and then it was 5. And pretty soon at like 3 o'clock, I needed to have a meeting up at the bar, you know, at like 3:30. And I didn't realize it, but I was drinking. Not only was I drinking every day, I was drinking every day for like 7 hours. And I was still, you know, maintaining a job, and I met a man at that job who liked to drink like I like to drink, and you know, we ended up getting married, and at this point, my drinking was taking on, was a little bit more serious. That guy was, you know, he worked at my work, but he was also like in a band. And he would, I don't know, it's kind of embarrassing when your husband, who's the heaviest partier in his band, needs to leave band practice to pick his wife up at the bar. And his bandmates are making fun of him for his drunk wife and her escapades at their shows. And, you know, so that's what happened. And we had this great life. So I thought, you know, building this great life, and I have my, you know, Bill Wilson, I had arrived, you know, moment where he and I are living in this wonderful loft in downtown Seattle, and we're both super professionals, and, you know, we're drinking a lot and partying a lot, but, you know, we made a host of fair weather friends, and, you know, and everything was going really well. But none of it was really real. Our relationship wasn't even real. And I can remember like looking around that loft and thinking, crap, is this it? Like, I have a nice car and I have a nice job and I live in a nice place and I'm married to a nice guy. And I just want to die. Like, I don't even want to be here. And, my, older sister who, you know, was a good older sister, but she was also the rebel of the family. And she had this horrific experience with cocaine when she herself was in college. And yeah, that was like, I'd done these recreational drugs all along, pot, shrooms, acid, X, blah, blah, blah. But the one thing she had warned me against was cocaine. Like, just don't do cocaine. It's a stupid drug. It'll take, you know, like, it took me out. You know, she ended up flunking out of community college and all these problems because of cocaine. And I had listened to her. You know, so it goes. I was pissed off at my husband one night, drunk. I have no idea why I was mad at him, to tell you the truth, but I was with some work friends, and one of them looked at me and said, "You want to try a line?" And it was literally at him, I said, "Yes." And 2 years later, I was in rehab. I'm definitely an alcoholic. When I pick up a drink, I cannot control the amount I take. And I have very little control over what I do. I would hope that someday I would have ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous anyway. But a friend of mine once said, you know, God bless cocaine because it took me down. And so I have to say God bless cocaine because it took me down. It took me down in 2 years. And it left me from that great loft apartment and a wonderful job. You know, it left me broken in an apartment on the other side of town, in a basement hole of an apartment. With my furniture was stacked on top of itself. We couldn't even fit our furniture into this place. And I had like a desk stacked on a table and chairs stacked on top. Like it was like a maze of furniture to walk through. Why we didn't get rid of it, I don't know. I think we had hopes that we would somehow get back to where we were. But I went down really, really quickly. And in that 2 year period, you know, some other stuff happened that I could blame. My mom had cancer and it had been in remission. Her cancer had come back. And as I was very quickly spiraling down, she died. This only served to give me more fuel for drinking and using. And I used it as an excuse. So at that 2 year period, you know, my husband, who had stopped drinking and using so much so that he could take care of me, was, you know, begging my family to step in. They were living here in California, couldn't really do anything, and were still reeling from my mother's death. You know, he was begging me to stop. I was basically telling him to F off and go away. And I was, you know, left, all I wanted to do was be left alone. And I woke up one day, he was on tour, and I was still high and drunk from the night before. I didn't even wake up. I don't even know if I went to sleep. But I But I decided I was going to leave that man, and I was going to pack a backpack and go live out on the streets in Seattle and become a stripper and a prostitute so that I could get what I wanted, more of what I wanted all of the time, and do whatever I had to do in order to get what I wanted all the time. And it would be okay to go be taken to jail sometimes, and it would be okay to end up in a hospital sometimes. Like, that would be a relief. And then I just go back out on the street, and I would proceed to live this pattern of living on the streets, going to jails and going to hospitals, prostituting myself and stripping if I could, you know, thinking I still looked good. And I would proceed to do that for 4 years, and then I would kill myself. This was my plan for living. This was my design for living. College graduate, husband who loved me, friends who missed me, family who, you know, was, you know, concerned, couldn't really do much, but still there. And that was my best thinking. That's where my drinking and drug use got me. And just so we're clear, because some people get confused, I didn't actually do any of those things. So just in case your minds are rattling, I know some people have that story. That's simply not mine. That was just my plan. Because, you know, we like to make plans. And did end up happening, and, you know, thank God for God, because there's absolutely no other reason that this brain, the way I'm telling you guys how my brain was thinking, that was the path that my brain was telling me to take. Yet, time gets really kind of screwy at this part, I think, for most of us. What ended up happening was another thought came into my head. And that thought was, what happened? What happened to your life? Like, this, when you were 5, Dan, is this the plan that you put together for your life? Is this actually what you're supposed to be doing? And of course, you know, the answer is simply no. There's got to be a better plan. There must be a better plan for living than this. I couldn't have been brought into this world just to go out and do this. My parents had gotten divorced, and I had a stepbrother who was addicted to crack cocaine. And he was the person that I thought to contact at this point. And he helped me to find a rehab in Long Beach, California. I went through that rehab. I worked those steps. I did sober living. And then I went back up to Seattle to that husband, who promised me that he had quit drinking, but he hadn't, and he shouldn't have at that point, and it's fine. But he and I didn't actually quite work out, and I stayed sober about a year, and then and I got bored. And I'll tell you, during that year, I'd worked most of my steps. Where I stopped working steps was around step 9. And what I never did in Alcoholics Anonymous was I never said yes. I remember going to a women's meeting in Seattle, and they said, "Danny, how about if you lead the meeting next week?" And my first thought was, "What? I don't know where I'm going to be next week. That sounds like a really big commitment. Like, I don't think I can help you with that. I'm sorry." And if people would ask me, you know, maybe go on panels or, you know, try to help some people out, my first thought was, "How could I possibly help you? I'm still so sick." Lo and behold, I made it 13 months, and I decided to pick up a drink. And there was nothing wrong that day. It was the end of a, you know, whatever, perfectly, you know, fine day, not a cloud on the horizon. And I decided to pick up a drink. And that started about a 6-month relapse, where I again ended up pretty much, you know, in the exact same place that I had the first time, not quite with the same plan, but with this exact same despair, absolute despair for living. And I thought, you know, again, I don't want to live this way. Maybe I don't have to. And today, when I talk about, like, the psychic change, then the doctor's opinion, it mentions the psychic change. And I realized that for me, that psychic change came with a maybe. Like, maybe I don't have to live this way. Maybe I can live a different life. Maybe I don't even have to live in Seattle. And 3 weeks later, my car was packed up and I was on the road back down to Long Beach. And I didn't have a job and I didn't have a place to live and I didn't have a whole lot of money and I didn't have a whole lot of anything, but I had hope. And I started going to my the home groups that I'd had when I went to rehab and done summer living before, and everyone said, "So glad you're back. Did you relapse?" "No. No. You know me, I'm Danny. Like, no, I'm perfect. I do everything perfectly. I do AA perfectly too, don't you know?" And I lied about it for a number of months, and it's so funny, it actually happened to be that now ex-husband of mine who I was talking to on the phone, and he was still getting loaded, and I was like, "You should, you know, do AA." I was all big book thumping to him, and he basically, you know, he's talking to me on the phone, and he said, "You know what, I don't want to hear about you and your AA BS." He said, "If there's one thing I know it's an honest program, and you are a goddamn liar. I know you're lying to all those people down there in Long Beach, so I don't want to hear it from you." And when we hung up the phone, all I thought was, dang it, like one drunk helping another. Because he was right, because he was absolutely right. And I proceeded to stand up in every single meeting I went to and announce a new sobriety date. You know, if I want to welcome all the people who are new in this meeting and new to AA or returning to AA, I especially want to welcome anyone who's, you know, lying or is a liar. Well, you're my people. But this time I looked at AA a little bit differently, and I didn't look at it so much as school, but I looked at it as really that design for living, and I worked my steps, you know, with a fervor that I hadn't before. You know, when people said, "Can you?" I just automatically said yes, even when I didn't want to, and I'm still doing it today. And, you know, I'm one of those alcoholics that considered myself of the educational variety. I had a really hard time with the God concept. You know, I was raised Jewish, and I did all those things that Jewish families do, but I never really bought in, and I didn't know who my God was, and I thought that AA at first was a Christian program and it was never going to work for someone like me. And that whole idea of being able to come up with a concept that, you know, worked for me outside of what was working for other people really enabled me to come in and stay for a while I figured out what that was. And I needed a lot of help. At about a year and a half sober, I totally went, excuse my language, I went absolutely batshit crazy. I had to go on medication for a while. I had to seek therapy. All of those things that I'm no longer needing to do. AA serves that, fills that for me. But I absolutely did need some outside help at that time. And because I was in AA, people who loved me helped me to find that help. And my life today is just, it's completely different than it was before. I have a life today. I have a really full and active life today. You know, since I've been sober, I have not only repaired some of those relationships that I left, that I abandoned by leaving California and then by, you know, delving so deeply into my alcoholism and drug addiction. I'm a runner, so I ran away from a lot of people that I've since been able to return to and been able to repair those relationships, and not just through making amends and doing that step 9, but by actually mending my behavior, changing my behavior, you know, really participating in those relationships. And I have friends today that are beyond anything I ever knew even existed. My whole life, I always thought that people were kind of an obligation. And I'm actually a really super social person until I'm not, until I just want to go away and do my thing. And I never really knew what being a true partner was all about. The 12 and 12, I studied the books a lot, and the 12 and 12 talks about in the fourth step, our complete inability to form a true partnership with another human being. And every time I read that, you know, I just realized how true it was, and I didn't know how to do that until other women began asking me for help. That absolutely has been one of the greatest gifts of this program, has been the friendships that I've been able to create with other women. They have taught me to love in the absolute healthiest way, and to be able to genuinely participate. We genuinely participate in each other's lives, and through learning how to sponsor other women, I learned how to be a better friend to my sister. I learned how to be a girlfriend to my boyfriend. I didn't know any of those things, and I love this program. You guys open up this meeting by talking about it being like this enthusiastic start to the week. And I was so excited because I'm just feeling really emotional right now. And I have a birthday coming up, I guess. But I am like AA's biggest cheerleader. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the friends that I found here. I love the 12 steps. I love that big book. I can't believe that some dudes back in 1939 had these stories and these experiences and these feelings that I'm like, oh my God, that's totally me. That's me, you know? And I just think it's like just this amazing thing. In sobriety, I have had failed relationships. I have lost jobs. I quit smoking. I had to have surgery and have painkillers. I've had some huge like family trauma stuff going on, and Alcoholics Anonymous has given me a solution to all of my problems today. I no longer have to turn to drugs and alcohol or anything else to escape from life. I love my life. I live it to the fullest every day. I'm certainly not perfect. I'm in a huge growth spurt in terms of finding kind of balance and a new sort of degree of serenity in my life and in my program right now. But I really do like, when I was drinking and using, I never went to jail. I never got arrested. I never got a DUI, you guys, not a one. And yet I was like a rat on a wheel in Groundhog Day, over and over and over again, same. And, today I don't, I have a really good, stable life. I still don't know exactly what's going to happen tomorrow, but I'm really excited to find out, and I can't, you say this is a enthusiastic beginning to your week. I'm so excited for my week. I have some new challenges ahead of me, and I just can't wait to find out what they are and walk through them, sober, happy, joyous, and free, exactly how God intended me to be. Thanks for my sobriety.